I invite you to turn in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 55. I read the first three or the first two and a half verses of Isaiah 55 this morning already, but I'm going to read through verse 5, at least for now, this morning. And what we're doing this Advent season and these weeks leading up to Christmas is we're tracing the promise of the prophets that God made, the promise that God made to David, the ancient Israelite King David. But we're tracing that promise through the ministry of Israel's prophets that actually lived after David, but saw how that promise was made to David and how that promise would ultimately be fulfilled in God's Messiah. Now that promise, if you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, which is tells the history of the early days of the monarchy in Israel, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, it specifically says that what God was going to do was establish a house, a dynasty, for David. This is what he said. God said to David, "When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom forever." A kingdom, he says three times actually, that will be established forever. Now, in the beginning of Isaiah, up to chapter 40 of Isaiah, there's a warning, lots of warnings. There's predictions, lots of predictions about terrible times that were to come for the people of Judah. That the nation of Babylon would come and would conquer them and would take them into exile. And as true as that was, and it happened exactly as it was predicted, Isaiah then shifts in chapter 40. And he reminds the people of their reason for hope, even in the midst of all of this. It's a hope that is rooted in the promise that was made to David, the promise of a Messiah who was going to come. And that's where Isaiah 55 fits. So let me invite you to stand, if you're able, as I read this. And when I finish, I'm going to make the declaration that this is the word of the Lord and invite you to respond by saying, "Thanks be to God." Isaiah chapter 55, starting at verse 1. "Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear that your soul may live, and I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. Behold, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. Behold, you shall call a nation that you do not know, and a nation that did not know you shall run to you because of the Lord your God and of the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you." This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. Now, I don't know if you've ever had this feeling about Christmas. I suspect maybe some of you had, but let me see if I can describe it, because I can never get like a really good word to kind of put to it. But let me see if I can describe it. When I was growing up, Christmas was a wonderful time in our house, filled with all kinds of family traditions and parties. And I'm a fairly nostalgic kind of a person, right? And so there were places that we would always go leading up to Christmas. There were decorations that went in familiar places in our house. There were cookies that we would decorate. There was music, specific, you know, albums that we would listen to at Christmas time. And over the years, as a kid, all of it kind of begins to gel together. You can't really place like, "Oh, we did this year, we did that year." It's all just kind of gelled together into this mental image of Christmas, of the ideal Christmas, whatever that might mean. But, and this is what I began to notice as I got a little bit older, what I would notice is that each year, I would have this intense anticipation, this longing for whatever that particular Christmas tradition might have been. But, as I was actually in the middle of experiencing that particular tradition, it was always really hard in the moment for it to live up to what I had anticipated it being. And it wasn't as if it was bad. It was just kind of like I would just be sitting there and say, like, "Okay, is this it? Like, am I feeling what I'm supposed to be to be feeling. I mean, this is good, but it's not exactly as I expected. And it's kind of confusing. What's wrong with me? Do I have unrealistic expectations? Or the thought, does the enjoyment of Christmas only come by looking back at it? Can you ever experience it in the moment? Is it only nostalgia? Can it really ever deliver in the moment? Have you ever had a feeling like that? That something that you're experiencing at the moment didn't exactly match, or you're wondering, does it really live up to the expectations that you had for it? The mental image of what you had made it to be, that it isn't completely met in reality. And that may very well have been how the people of Israel would have But when they actually got post-David and post this promise to the kings that came after David, instead of righteous and loving and just rule, for the most part, there had just been corruption and injustice, and now even more suffering on the way for them. And the resulting feeling, potentially, could have been one of confusion. Did we misread the promises here? Should we lower our expectations, perhaps, of what God has in store for us? What are we missing? And it's into this question, it's into this feeling that God speaks here, by bringing clarity to that confusion, by helping us understand what the problem is and what fixes us. Now, what this passage shows us, explains to us, is four things, or four categories of things. This is how I want to break it down. We see that there is a universal longing for something. We see, number two, that there is a failed pursuit that we all engage in to go after that universal longing. But, three, there is an eternal solution. And four, a needed response. Okay? One, a universal longing. Two, a failed pursuit. Three, an eternal solution. And four, a needed response. Now, first, what God does through the prophet Isaiah is he validates for us a universal longing. Look at verse 1 again. This will be the third time that I've read it. But listen, come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Now, this is one of the clearest, most powerful invitations to come from God in the entire Bible. And it resonates with people when you ring it, this invitation. Why? Why does it? Well, because it hits home because it is a universal longing to be satisfied, to be filled, to be quenched, to be cared for, to connect with something greater than yourself. It's a universal invitation because it's addressed to everyone. Because we're all thirsty, right? What's being offered here is what everyone really wants. Now, what's being offered? Well, you see in verse 1, what's being offered? Come to the waters. Water? Water is being offered, but not just water. Did you see? Come buy wine and milk, too. So you've got water, wine, and milk. And what a lot of the commentators will point out is when you actually see these three things together, you cover basically the three great classes of drink. Right? Water to quench the thirst, wine to gladden the heart, and milk to strengthen the body. That's what each of them would have represented in their categories. Refreshment, exhilaration, nourishment. Satisfaction, joy, strength. That's what God's offering here. And not just the common variety stuff, because he says it's rich food. Rich stuff is being offered here. Now, this is a universal longing. Blaise Pascal, the famous 17th century philosopher, mathematician, in one of his most famous books, this is what he wrote. He said, all men seek happiness. All men. This is without exception. Whatever means they employ, they all tend to this end. The cause of some going to war and of others avoiding it is the same desire in both, attended with different views. The will never takes the least step but to this object. This is the motive and action of every man. You see what he's saying? Pleasure, purpose, happiness, wine, water, milk. No one takes the least step, Pascal said, but toward that object. It's all of our ultimate desire. the satisfaction of our souls. And that's what God's offering. Right? You see, what this means then is that what we long for in life, our perfect satisfaction, this exhilarating joy, this unmovable strength, they're all good things. We don't have unrealistic expectations when we want them. And when experience doesn't match them, we shouldn't lower our sights and just settle for less. We are right to want something more. Now, it may be at this point a little bit of an overused sermon illustration because the story's been told a number of times, but he's still playing football, so I'm going to still continue to tell the story. Back in 2005, Tom Brady was then with the New England Patriots, and he was interviewed by CBS's 60 Minutes, a news magazine that aired on Sunday nights. And back in 2005, so more than 15 years ago, he was 28 years old, and he had at that point already reached an amazing level of success. He had three Super Bowl rings, two Super Bowl MVPs, right? This huge, you know, huge contract, supermodel girlfriend, right? Everything that the world would say, you've got it. But this is what he said to Steve Croft, who was interviewing him. He said, "Why do I have three Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me?" He says, "I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey, man, this is what it is. I've reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me, I think, God, it's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be what it's all cracked up to be." Now listen to what he said. If you've ever seen the interview, if you've ever watched, he's not particularly disillusioned or discouraged or depressed or bitter or any of those things. He's just, he just matter-of-factly kind of says, like, there's got to be something else. There's got to be something more. Right? God, it's got to be something more than this. And sort of like an ironically prayer-phrased statement, that's what he says. But it's through that statement that we begin to see the problem with the universal longing. The problem with the universal longing is not that we're looking for the wrong thing, satisfaction, joy, strength. It's not that we're looking for the wrong thing, it's that we're looking for the right thing in the very wrong place, right? So number one leads to number two. We have a universal longing, but number two, there is a failed pursuit. Now, check out verse two. Isaiah asks an extremely insightful question that cuts right to the heart of the issue. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Do you see what he's doing? He's not challenging the longing for bread or for satisfaction. He's challenging how they go about trying to get it. You want bread? Good. Good. Bread's a good thing. Bread is not what you're buying. He just tells them. You want to be satisfied? Good. But that's not what you're working for. The longing is right, but the pursuit fails because you're trying to make things bread that aren't bread. George John Romaine was an English evolutionary biologist, a psychologist who lived in the second half of the 19th century. He was a contemporary, one of the youngest friends in the circle of Charles Darwin, but you've probably never heard of him. But like many intellectuals of the late Victorian era, Romaine walked away from what had been a childhood Christian faith for him, and he walked away because, at least from what he had experienced of Christianity did not seem relevant to him. It didn't seem to be able to answer the questions of the modern world. He didn't think it satisfied. So he looked elsewhere. He looked in science, he looked in philosophy, he looked in art, and he became extremely successful in all of those fields. But as he grew older, he began to see how those pursuits failed to satisfy his ultimate longing. Listen to what he wrote in one of his books. Now, this is a little bit of a dense quote, but the image that he uses at the end is where I want you to focus. Listen, he says, "I know from experience the intellectual distractions of scientific research and philosophical speculation and artistic pleasures. But I am also well aware that even when all are taken together and well sweetened to taste in respect of the resulting reputation, means, social position, etc." He says, "I'm well aware that the whole concoction, the whole mixture, in other words, of scientific research and philosophical speculation and artistic pleasure, I'm well aware that the whole concoction is, listen to this, that it is but as high-class confectionery for starving men. You hear that? High-class confectionery for starving men. You hear that metaphor? He's saying that the wonderful benefits of pursuing science and philosophy and art, the benefits, the reputation, the means, the social position, all of those things that he says pursuing those things gets you, all of them is nothing more. They're nothing more than high-class confectionery for starving men. Confectionery, it's candy, success, money, social standing. It's like feeding candy to the starving. Tastes good. Temporarily may make you feel full, but it does nothing to really satisfy, and ultimately it will just make you sick. In other words, it's not bread. Why spend money on that which is not bread and your labor on that which does not satisfy? Why spend money on candy? That's what Isaiah is asking. Now, what about you? Think about this for a second. What's your confectionery? Right? What's your candy? And it can be almost anything. But let me just take this for an example. For many of us, it's this. Right? It's the little black rectangle, in my case, that we carry around everywhere. You can do almost anything now, it seems, from this. You can check your email from anywhere, right? You want to know the score of the game, no problem. Right? You want to listen to music, right here. You want to know how late Target is open today, you can check. Read a book, listen to a book, watch a movie, order your dinner, find out who's at your front door. You can do it all right here. Now, what do we love about that? Right? What do we really connect with about that and say, ah, that's really cool? What do we really connect? What does it offer us? Well, I suppose at some level, what appeals to us is the control that it offers. Right? Information at my fingertips. Apps, you know, if you're an organized person, you know, all in neat little rows. I just click this, I touch that, and things happen immediately when I swipe or touch. Right? Respond to my command at the touch of my finger. Now, ultimately, it doesn't work. As many of you know, I have five children, and it may surprise you, but there are times, in the occasional moment, when control is a difficult thing to find in a home like that. The sense of like life being neatly ordered in little rows where all you got to do is touch something or swipe something, and it happens exactly as you want it to happen. You might imagine that occasionally that's something that's elusive. And this is what can easily happen with this little device that follows us everywhere, right? And I notice it in myself. Perhaps you've noticed it in you. Whenever things become particularly chaotic, right? You know, maybe it's bedtime or after dinner, or there's piles of laundry to fold, or there's demands from every side, right? Where do you find yourself being drawn? To the little black rectangle. Why? Because we're wired for control in the midst of the apparent chaos. And I can go there and something will happen immediately when I touch it, exactly what I wanted it to do. And that, well, that's attractive. Now, here's the thing, right? Is there anything wrong with the things that, in the midst of a modern society, the individual things that this little black rectangle can do for us at times? No, not necessarily. Is there anything wrong, take it another level, is there anything wrong with the desire for there to be order, for there to be purpose in the midst of chaos, to have a confidence that what seems out of control is in fact controllable? No, that's a universal longing. That's a good longing. All right, but what's the problem? The problem is not what I'm looking for when I pick up the little black rectangle. The problem is where I'm trying to find what I'm looking for. My pursuit fails because I'm going to something, looking for something in a little black rectangle that only God is able to provide. I'm buying candy and thinking it's bread. Now, what I perceive as chaos may pale in comparison to what you experience as chaos, and my choice of confectionery may be different than your choice of confectionery, but the principle applies to all of us. What's your candy? Where do you go when you're looking really for bread? Right? Maybe it's actual candy. Right? You know, the bag of chocolate chips that you said you were going to bake cookies with, but well. right? Maybe it's something else. But in every case, what we do is we waste money, we waste effort on things that may not be bad in themselves, but will never succeed in filling us. The retired pastor John Piper, he rattles off a list of them. He says that this is the failed pursuit of humanity, he says. Still working, dreaming, chasing, searching, experimenting, different job, different city, different car, different house, different wife, new computer, new boat, new books, new bike, new grill, new season tickets, new diet, new looks. That's what we do. Confectionery when we're looking for bread. All right, so what do? We have a universal longing. We have a failed pursuit of that longing. But there is, God offers us through Isaiah an eternal solution. Now, what's the solution? Look at the second half of verse 3. I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. So what's happening here? What's happening here is that God is promising an everlasting covenant to everyone who comes to him. Remember, the call is to come. And to those who come, they become part of an everlasting, eternal covenant. And this is a rock-solid promise. This is, sure love is the word that's used here, right? It goes well beyond the casual way in which we use the word love or throw that around, right? This is the merciful, loving kindness of God that isn't deserved, but is nonetheless given to us with absolute certainty. Because it is based on the certainty of an eternal agreement that God made with David. Now, who's the object of that promise again? It's back where we started. It's a king out of the line of David who will rule for all eternity, right? This language here in Isaiah is messianic language. Now, ultimately, that Messiah of whom Isaiah was speaking is Jesus. Now, where do we get that? How do we get to there? How do we know? Well, the Apostle Paul actually references this verse, Isaiah 55:3. He references it in Acts 13, right? The story of the early church, the ministry of the Apostle Paul after the death and the resurrection and the ascension of Jesus. In Acts 13, Paul is in Pisidian Antioch, and he's invited to address the synagogue. And at length, he recounts how the covenant promise of God leads to Jesus. And he references David, and he says in Acts 13:23, from this man's descendants, from David's descendants, God has brought to Israel the Savior Jesus as he promised. And then, just a little further on in Acts 13, verse 34, as part of his support for the resurrection of Jesus, Paul cites this covenant promise of Isaiah 55:3. And what Paul is doing when he does that, right, what Paul is saying, what Isaiah is saying, is that the everlasting covenant, the faithful love, that is the solution for our universal longing for satisfaction. Right? It's an eternal person. That's what will satisfy. And if an eternal person who, like it says in verses 4 and 5, will be a witness to the peoples and who will lead them and summon people from all nations to come to him. It's a person. It's Jesus Christ. That's the answer to our longing. Now here's what we're really looking for. Right? When we go to our phones or we go to food or we go to whatever we go to in a moment of stress, this is what we're really looking for. We're looking for a person. We're looking for Jesus, right? I want to control my universe. And what Isaiah is saying here is my ability, my desire to control my universe, that is a foolish illusion. Because what I'm really looking for at that moment when I seek control in the midst of chaos, what I'm really looking for is assurance that the world is not out of control, that it is not spinning wildly off of its axis, right? If that's what is truly true, then I am a fool to think that a little black rectangle or a bag of candy or whatever it is going to give me that kind of assurance. But instead, let me show you practically how this works. If at that moment, when you feel the stress, when you feel the anxiety, when you feel the longing for the right thing, if at that moment, what if I thought about this? What if I realize that throughout centuries and centuries of apparent chaos in the history of Israel, chaos that quite honestly makes the chaos that we're experiencing, right, look relatively tame, right? What if I remembered that for centuries and centuries, throughout all of this apparent chaos, God was very carefully, perfectly controlling all of history to bring it to the climax so that at just the right time, in the right moment, God would send his son into human history. Right? If at that moment of my chaos, I look to Jesus and I realize that I have that kind of God, then I don't need anything else to tell me that I've got everything under control. I have the ultimate assurance that everything's under control because Jesus proves that everything's under control. How could it not be? Right? His birth, his death, his resurrection, all perfectly timed, predicted hundreds and hundreds of years in advance, right? Brought to their fulfillment at the exact right moment. The eternal solution is a person. It's Jesus. Now, I haven't completely solved the problem. See, here's the real problem. The offer that the Son of David is extending here in verse 1, to buy and eat without money and without cost, right? That's great. That's a wonderful offer, right? Here's some bread. Eat it without cost. But here's the problem. What do we know about bread? Anyone ever taken just basic economics course? Basic economics course, right? There's this technical principle known as tenstoffel. Tenstoffel, this basic economic principle. We learn it. It's a technical term. It stands for there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. Right? Technical economic term, right? See, if we don't have any money, and we don't, go back to verse 1, right? If we don't have any money, then you can't just walk into a grocery store, pick a loaf of bread off the shelf, and walk out the door. You can't do that. Unless, of course, someone buys it for you. Now, but the real problem is that the bread we need to buy is not on sale for a few bucks at ShopRite. It's like this. Lots of talk about inflation today, right? All of it, we're experiencing inflation. You see it in the news, right? Well, in 2008, in the African country of Zimbabwe, the misguided policies of President Mugabe resulted in one of the worst cases of hyperinflation in recorded history. Hyperinflation, where prices for basic goods just spiraled, just out of control. In November of 2008, prices were doubling in Zimbabwe, doubling every 24 hours. Right? So the annual inflation rate actually reaches, when you do that, that reaches like 78% or something like that. That's the, like, eventually they stopped using the currency. They couldn't. It made no sense. They switched to the South African rand or the U.S. dollar, whatever people would take. Right? A loaf of bread, technically speaking, under this kind of like, was like $35 million or something like that. Like if you actually put dollar figures to it, that's what a loaf of bread like with this hyperinflation would have cost you. Now, we don't like to think of it that way, but because of our rebellion against God, our sin, our misguided policies, right? We have created a state of hyperinflation, right? We have a valid universal longing, but because of our rebellion, of our failed pursuit, we are completely and totally priced out of the market to even think about buying the bread that we require and the bread we desire, right? The loaf of bread, in other words, does not that we need. That is the satisfaction for our universal longing, right? It doesn't cost $2 at Starbucks. It costs $35 million. That's the real problem here, right? Your buddy, your friend could spot you $2 to go buy a loaf of bread if that's what it costs. But who has $35 million that they can give you for a loaf of bread? Who has that? Those kinds of resources, the Son of David. See, the trouble with jumping right into Isaiah 55 is that you might miss the context. But go back later and look and read the chapters that lead up to Isaiah 55, because the invitation of Isaiah 55 comes in light of the tremendous blessings that God promises to his people in Isaiah 54. And the only way that the blessings of Isaiah 54 and the resulting invitation of Isaiah 55 come, the only way that can happen is because the Son of David buys it for us in Isaiah 53. There's a progression. If you go back to Isaiah 53, it's 700 years before it happened to Jesus. Isaiah tells us of a Messiah, the same Messiah who is the Son of David and who is the witness, the leader, and the commander in Isaiah 55. This same Messiah, Isaiah tells us in 53, in order to get to this point where we can be offered satisfaction without cost to us, the way that that happens is for the Messiah to provide it. And he can't get any clearer than the way that he says it in Isaiah 53, verses 5 and 6. Speaking of this Messiah, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, to our own candy, to our own confectionery. We've all turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That's how it happens. You see, that's how it happens. Right? He gets the punishment, we get the peace. He's wounded, we're healed. Jesus buys the bread. That's how it comes to us at no cost. Now, finally, there is a needed response, right? So that the invitation, that invitation is hanging out there in Isaiah 55. Remember, verse 1, come, everyone who thirsts, come, he who has no money, come, buy, eat, come, buy wine and milk and without money and without price, right? One verse, right, only 5 lines of poetry and 4 very direct commands to come. And then, we didn't read this before, but take a look at verses 6 and 7. Just to add emphasis, this is what it says. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord that he may have compassion on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Here's a question for you. What are you going to do with your thirst? The fact that you thirst is undeniable. It's a universal longing. All of us have it. All of us seek to satisfy it in some way. But where will you go with yours? In the C.S. Lewis book, The Silver Chair, that's one of the book 4 in the Chronicles of Narnia, the stories that Lewis wrote. And this girl named Jill has stumbled into Narnia. That's the fantasy land where all the great adventures happen in these books. And Jill is alone, and she's been separated from her friend, and she's scared, and she's crying, and she's upset. And she stops crying because she realizes how incredibly thirsty she's become. And that's when she hears running water. Somewhere there's water. There's a stream. It's somewhere around here. And she goes looking for it, and she finds this crystal clear stream. And that makes her even thirstier. But she stops just as she starts going towards the stream, because lying there, right next to the stream, is this great lion, Aslan. Now, if you know the Narnia books, then you know that Aslan is the great ruler of Narnia. He's the king. And this is how it goes. This is how it goes between Jill and the lion, Aslan, right? Aslan says to her, "If you're thirsty, you may drink." And for a second, she stared here and there, wondering who had spoken. And then the voice said again, "If you're thirsty, come and drink." Ain't the invitation? Jill realized that it was the lion speaking to her. "Are you thirsty?" said the lion. "I'm dying of thirst," said Jill. "Then drink," said the lion. "May I? Could I? Would you mind going away while I do?" said Jill. The lion answered this only by a look and a very low growl. "Okay, will you promise not to do anything to me if I come?" Jill said. I make no promise, said the lion. Jill was so thirsty now that without noticing it, she had come a step nearer. Do you eat girls? She asked. I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms, said the lion. It didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it. I daren't come and drink, said Jill. Then you will die of thirst, said the lion. Oh dear, said Jill, coming another step nearer. I suppose I must go and look for another stream then. There is no other stream, said the lion. The water for which we all thirst is the water of the great King, Jesus. He invites us to drink, and we don't get to set the conditions, but his water is the only water that will satisfy. There is no other stream. Let's pray. Our Father, only you can satisfy perfectly the thirst of every person here this morning. Only you are rich enough to buy the bread that we need to eat. Lord, forgive us for wasting our resources and our efforts on those things that will never meet our longings. God, I don't know each of the individual needs of the people in this room this morning, but you do. And Lord, I pray that where there is sadness, you would bring comfort. Where there is pain, you would bring healing. Where there is happiness, let it lead to thanksgiving and praise to you, the giver of great joy. And Lord, help us to be mindful of the price that you have paid for that joy, the price paid by Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen.